Hello, welcome to Your Mind Matters, NPL's first mental health podcast where we discuss mental health and everything that is related to that. I'm Bassam Habib, the Be Well at NPL program manager.
And I am Lana Bolijak. I am in the Education and Literacy Department.
And today we have Lydia Yusuf with us, the director of El Mahabba Center here in Nashville, Tennessee. Lydia, what's going on?
Hello, hello. Thank you for inviting me.
We're about to have a conversation.
We are about to have a conversation.
Yes, I just want to prepare you for that.
Yeah, it's going to get real in here.
It's going to get real.
Let's do it. I'm here for it. Nashville needs it.
How do you like driving to the main branch library?
I hate it. I hate downtown. I hate the construction. Mm. I hate all the little touristy people. I wanted to put a tally of all the people who definitely do not live here, but are impacting our legislation and how we view this city.
There is a lot of asbestos, I feel like, in the air from all the construction that's happening downtown.
Mm-hmm. It's not a good vibe. Even with like the what is it called? The sky, the clear skies.
Yes, the
and
sky.
And everything, yeah.
What is the name of that thing?
Downtown has a very dystopic vibe to it, mm-hmm. but... Yeah, and I was just coming back from the Horn, too, so I was leaving little South Nashville to come here, but I'm excited to be in conversation with you all.
The Horn has upped their game.
They have.
What is the Horn? They have.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God,
Briefer on the Horn real quick, and then let's get it.
Okay, this has become a podcast about about food in Nashville. I'm a tourist, so this matters to me. The Horn is a Somali coffee shop. Mm-hmm. In South Nashville, just like 15 minutes, 10 minutes from here, right near the airport in the Melwood area, which predominantly was a lot of Egyptian and Somali and Ethiopian community members living there. So it's a very important site for all of us. Their chai is so
fire.
Good.
Ooh, I bet.
There's some samosas. Yeah. Shout out to the Horn. Yeah.
Yes.
But Sam was telling me that you read a lot.
Yeah, so. I used to. Now,
nice.
I would love to read again. Yeah.
Well, we can switch up the
we can.
No. Ask me what you were going to ask
me. We're locked in.
We were going to ask you your reading right now, what your favorite books are, if you have any recommendations.
Okay, yeah. So the last book, I was reading Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Well, okay. It was auto.
Just a light read.
Yeah. I was feeling really depressed about things happening in Nashville. So I was like, what can I tap into? Mm-hmm. So Pedagogy of the Oppressed on audiobook, because I do a lot of deliveries and a lot of meetings. So I'm always running around in my car and I don't have time to actually sit down and read a book. But I was like, someone got me on audiobooks. So that's what I was... Yeah.
Cool. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
That sounds
Pedagogy of the Press.
It pairs really well with Wretched of the Earth as well.
Yes.
Pairs really well
France
with
Fanon.
That. France Fanon.
Yes.
Those two books. I highly recommend them together.
Yes.
But you need to be going to therapy while you're reading these.
Yeah. Ooh. I actually, you know, it is a heavy read, but it is really important. Like, for the past couple of months, because of what's been happening at Metro Arts, we should have timed how long it took me to get to this topic. I have felt very gaslit and very... And very like, what happened to y'all was bad, but y'all get over it. Bad things happen all the time in Metro and, you know, move on. And so, you know, to tap into what people were going through in the 60s, 70s and 80s and to feel like people have experienced what we have experienced. People have organized against what we want to organize against. So it renewed my hope in a sense like all... Everyone, whatever they're saying, it's been said. People have gone through it. People have been gaslit. People have been told, stop, don't do what you're doing. And people persisted and they changed their existence and they changed the circumstances that they were living in. So I encourage people to read books and I encourage them to tap into the larger picture. And I feel like books give us that and allow us to come out of our own sense of like, this is what this person told me. Everybody around me is saying something, and books are like, well, here's what reality is, and here's what the history is. James Baldwin said that quote about you think you're the only one who suffered, but then you read a book and you realize, you know,
there's
you're not the only one.
There.
Yeah.
For anyone that's like actually listening to this, we do have people listening to this.
Yeah.
But maybe first, let's like rewind a little bit. Talk about Mahabba, talk about yourself a little bit to introduce yourself.
Who is the crazy woman?
Who is this crazy woman that's sitting next to us right now?
Yeah. So I basically am one of the people in Nashville who remembers when you did not have to pay for parking. So I've been here for a hot minute. I was born in New Jersey to two Coptic, so Egyptian Christian people. And my parents moved us here to the South for better opportunities, and because my father was told he wasn't going to get promoted at his Rite Aid job. And he said, you know what, I'm going to start my own business. And he wanted to move closer to my mother's side of the family, and so moved us to the South. And so ever since, I've just been here as a Coptic person. And I've seen what my community members and Bassam's community members have gone through for decades of being made invisible, of a lot of our labor being funneled into the city to help it grow, help this airport grow, help the tourist industry. This is why I get triggered when I see tourists. So, yeah, and a lot of that, you know, still people. I just had someone last week who came up to me and said, oh, in Mahaba Center, the Kurdish community. And I said, no, Arabs and Kurds are not the same. Oh, my God. It's 2024 in Nashville. The Arab community has been here for decades, since the 80s. The Kurdish community, same thing. So, yeah, we have a long way to go. So we formed in Mahaba in 2019, Veronica Nashid, my sister Irini Youssef, and myself, to really address the lack of resources coming into our communities, whether through the government or through the nonprofit structure. The nonprofit industry complex is another thing that we try to tackle at in Mahaba. So from there, the rest is kind of history. So we started with a lot of direct services. We still do a lot of direct services. That's very important to us, to stay connected to community members and to feel like we're being responsive to community members as well. And then obviously when you're on the ground a lot, and you're talking to people, you're making deliveries, you're on the phone a lot with people who need to be navigated to another resource, you really realize all the discrepancies within government and nonprofits, and like the lack of resources, the lack of translation and language access. And I don't want in Mahaba to be a one-stop shop. I hate that term. And I always say, like, if in Mahaba has done its job well, we'll be dissolved in 20 years. And that means our community made it through a very, very rough patch in our history, and we don't need a nonprofit to hold us up. And so really the goal of In Mahaba is to connect community members through mutual aid, through campaign, through advocacy, through direct services, so that we are building our own networks and our own systems of prosperity that don't have to deal with nonprofits and government. So that's the goal of In Mahaba. We're always transforming. We have always different services. We're always building out different ideas. I never tell a community member no as much as possible when they come to me with an idea or a need. And we just fill in the gaps as much as possible. And finally, we have 5 board members. We now have 1 full-time staff, but still me, full-time staff, and a part-time staff member. So slowly building.
Awesome. That's lovely to hear.
If you want to see like a microcosm of racism.
It's a word.
Yes. microbiome or whatever. In historical action, most recent here in Nashville. Check out the Nashville International Airport or Gaylord Opryland. Oh. It was literally built by immigrants like Egyptians, Somalis, Ethiopians. Mm. We built the airport. I worked at the airport for 2 years. I think everybody's just ran
family.
Everybody
my brother did.
It.
Yeah.
And so all the workers that are like on the ground doing the cleaning, doing the like control of everything, the food in the, like the food court and everything are just immigrants, and the airport management is just
and specifically African immigrants.
Yeah, specifically African immigrants, which is you know, so you think it'd be something, but check
it
out. Next time you're in the National International Airport, take a peek at who's pushing.
Around.
Yeah, take a look around at who's pushing the wheelchairs.
Yeah.
But
connect with people. I shouldn't have to explain that Arabic is the 3rd most spoken language here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's obvious, but and you know, it harms our people too. Like a lot of people always ask me, because they think this is an appropriate question, where can I get good Egyptian food? And I really want to launch into the whole topic of like, you can't get good Egyptian food. Mm-hmm. Like you can't buy it. You have to know an auntie. in Nashville. And you know why? Because y'all have made us so invisible in this city that our community members don't even feel like they can interact with y'all as they are.
Yeah, yeah. We're like, yeah, 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 I'm Greek.
Yeah, like literally anything else. Yeah, they do not want to identify as Egyptian or Arab because of the amount of hatred and vitriol that they get from people in Nashville.
Well, post 9/11, I think it was just not a hot thing to be Arab.
True.
You know,
like so a national. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just, for sure.
But I feel like it makes me sad when you see like communities that are thriving in Dearborn and Chicago and California with a very strong Arab presence. And we have a very strong, in numbers, very strong Arab and Egyptian community. And there's not even close. Like, this such a fascinating community because it's, like, so invisible and so under the radar. Yeah. And so, like, we don't have any kushri spots. We don't have any, like, hawashi, like, food trucks, nothing. So, you know, that's the
King
impact
Tut.
Of racism.
We got King Tut.
We do have King Tut.
Most recent, but. Okay, so let's get deep.
Yeah, let's go.
All right, so you, in your description of Al-Mahabba Center, you said a lot of words that people might not be familiar with, such as mutual aid. So can you break down, like, what that looks like in our community? What is mutual aid?
Yeah.
And then what does that look like in the Arab community? And how do you see that tie it into the mental health of the community too.
Like, oh yeah,
how you see like people's mental health is affected by that.
Yeah, so I do want to put a disclaimer there that I don't think what I say is that we do mutual aid at Al-Mahabba. We don't do it perfectly, and I think that that's important to note that it's very hard to do it in the way that it was intended to be done. And mutual aid is different than charity. So charity is top-down model without really analyzing why there are people at the top, why are there people at the bottom, and negotiating that inequity. So mutual aid first looks at that inequity and says, okay, can somebody at the top who's like donating all this money to quote-unquote, you know, the people at the bottom, the poor people, the peasants, is that really like traditional charity, does that really change anything? And this has been like, you can read multiple books on this. I'm one of those people who believes that it actually reinforces power. It's not a neutral system of just like, oh, I did something. The way I got this money may not have been ethical, but it doesn't matter because I'm giving it back to the poor. So for instance, like companies like Walmart, most of their employees are on EBT and food stamp. They don't pay a living wage. So they may say that, look, we have a foundation at Walmart that funds all these great organizations and we're giving back to the community when they're not paying a living wage. And actually, we're still paying their employees from our taxes to be on EBT when they could just be paying their taxes and giving a living wage, right? Hmm. So mutual aid first looks at that system within the United, well, within the world, and then says the real way to do, to support people like a newcomer who needs furniture. They just came to Egypt, and they only have a suitcase. How can we actually support this person? Because at the end of the day, they need a bed and they need a living room and they need a dining room. It's not by going to the Walmart Foundation or going to all these rich foundations and people and asking them to give money. It's instead mutual between community members. So this is something we've been trying to set up through Al-Mahabba. So like a mother who's had a car seat or a stroller after her baby grows up can give it to us and we'll give it to another mom. Instead of going to one of these large foundations and saying, pretty please, like, can we get these strollers and car seats for these moms? Now, of course, we don't have a perfect system, like I said, but that's the idea of mutual aid, is to support community members through community members. So it's a horizontal system instead of a top-down model, which can be harmful. So, and you said, how does this connect to mental health?
Yeah, so
let me talk actually about the Arab community, too, because that's what you were asking first.
Yeah.
So I saw this in our community very early on. And of course, one of the benefits to being a community that's very invisible, specifically the Coptic community in Nashville, which is the largest of the Arabic speaking communities, is that none of the nonprofits and government want to work with you and are ignoring you. So people in the community have to set up the mutual aid network themselves. And they have to do that from scratch. And that takes a lot of labor, a lot of labor. And, you know, and that includes not just like giving things, like not just like, hey, this community member is sick. Can someone cook for them? Because they don't have anyone to cook for them. This person is getting a baby. Can we donate a nursery? Like, figure that out. Can someone take care of the mom? It's also a culture of like, you know, when someone passes away, we are at that funeral. We are going to the condolences at their house. We're making sure they're taken care of. It's a collectivist culture that's right next to the material sharing of resources. So I was growing up, my parents always made sure that we were kind of part of those networks. And I think Bassam's family as well. This was a very normal practice within our community because we knew no one was coming for us. We were all we had.
For a period of time, we were targeted by... we were targets of the metro departments, like police, social services.
Yeah.
All of the ones that are predatory. Yeah. None of the ones that are helpful.
Yeah. And so it really, I think mutual aid done well is... It comes from a community that is connected to one another, not just like materially, not through material, but like socially and emotionally. Mm. So if you come to a diaper bank, you will see like the moms check in on one another and talk to one another. And they have that, they're not just picking up diapers, but they're making connections with one another and checking in with one another, checking in with the kids, saying, hey, I can drive your kid this day to school. And that's kind of the spaces that we want to make sure our community members have, that there is a sense of collectivism over individuality and over like, I can do this by myself, which is very, very much the culture in the United States. And it's very, very toxic. And so I'm very proud that we have been able to retain that for decades within the Coptic community here in Nashville. And that's something in Mahabba we directly claim as something that's very important to all of us to retain. Because a lot of immigrants, when they come to the U.S., they're like, we have to change. You have to become a quote-unquote American. You have to be an individual, and you have to do what their culture wants. You have to be a consumer. You have to just obey the law, quote-unquote. And a lot of immigrants succumb to that culture and to that narrative. And then you will find a lot of self-loathing immigrants. It's very common. And we just want to actively fight against that through the mutual aid and also through really the larger cultural piece that we're trying to push through.
Yeah, I just got a new car, a truck.
Oh,
It's not new. It's very used and
I also
down.
Got a new car.
Yeah, so seeing this in action is that we got a couple mechanics in the city.
Yeah,
but my boy Nagy, he is out in Laverne. So I've been taking this truck to him, and he's just helping me, like, figure everything out. Because, so my teta, my grandmother, her, like, sister knew his mom back in Egypt, where they were from. Mm. And he was, like, BFFs with my uncle, who passed away. And then, thank you. And then now he's like, oh, he's treating me like family instead of like, so you know what I mean? It's coming down through this like lineage, just like outside of Nashville, even just through like, we're from the same like city, or your grandma or your mom is from the same like area. So I got you, like we'll work together. So now he's just like showing me everything in this car and like breaking it down, and like it's like really helping out in the so staying within that community, we're able to like provide that education and literacy without programming. It just goes like, we don't have to create these like institutions that are like, all right, we're gonna have like literacy for, you know, this specific demographic or something like that. It just comes naturally because there's lineage and and it's outside of Egypt.
Yes.
And we're doing it here. So.
And remembrance. I think memory is a very, 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 very important. And that's why we have an oral history project through In Mahabha Center too. And that's why we're continually trying to capture the history of our people so that the narrative is ours and it's not, you know, an outside force coming in and erasing it or ignoring it.
I kind of want to dig a little deep into like personal, just like what you have experienced as a member of Nashville's Arabic community, a member of an immigrant community, and how you view multiculturalism and diversity and how that has affected your mental health and what you've seen in your community is how that affects y'all's mental health as a whole. I mean, I have, and I speak as a member of a diverse community, but not an immigrant community. So I can understand from that aspect, but I cannot imagine what it's like to leave your home and your culture behind for another one and see people kind of ignoring. You had mentioned feeling kind of invisible. How has that impacted your mental health? And why is that important for people who are not in that community to understand?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of mental health has to do with the material reality, first and foremost. So a lot of our community members, for decades, their government will not operate in Arabic. So and especially if you're an immigrant, so I think starting off with saying, like, mental health is part of a response to the material conditions and reality for so many people. So, so when we're discussing mental health, we want to also look at, like, the material conditions that impact mental health. So for a lot of our community members, specifically within the Coptic community, a lot of our community members have come here via lottery visa, which means they paid thousands of dollars, their family has paid thousands of dollars to get them into the system, get their application ready. They paid lawyers. They waited 7 to 10 years for their application to process. They come to the U.S. and they come to Nashville. They're walking out of that airport and now they have all of these things to think about because our community members are not within the refugee community, which means, you know, refugees have to apply through another system and then are brought to the U.S. and then told this is where you're going to live. These are the schools, and they have support through the government, through the federal government. But obviously, that's also that's a whole other different structure. That's a whole set of problems and mental health crisis of, like, not dealing with refugees as if they are human beings, but just, like, moving them through the process of, like, checking, you know, each person. And yes, this person is accounted for and this is who we can move to this factory to work. It's a very dehumanizing system. And I really encourage people to talk to refugees and immigrants because migration in and of itself is a huge toll. But then when you have to deal with war, with persecution, with the U.S. government, a lot of times telling people you can't apply to be a refugee or you can't apply for asylum because it doesn't matter what your husband was doing to you in Guatemala or Egypt. That's not, you know, you don't need the support or you don't need you can't apply for asylum and your application is denied. So the whole process of just dealing with the U.S. government and the U.S. court system that immigrants and refugees have to deal with is really, really traumatizing. And God bless all the first gen and what they have to go through. So then you're in BNA Airport, you're walking around, everything's in English, you don't know any English, or maybe limited English, and you have to figure out housing, you have to figure out schools for your kids, you have to figure out a job, and you don't have a car, and you're in Nashville. You have to figure out what HR is in a department, and you have to figure out if I'm enrolling my kid, how long are they going to be in the school? Oh, my younger kid needs daycare. And for immigrants, there's no support apparatus for that. And unfortunately, the government and nonprofits don't have that apparatus because there's no funding for it, especially for nonprofits. So a lot of the nonprofits don't care. And so our community members have had to pull together and, like we were talking about, that mutual aid network to create that. So how this comes back to multiculturalism is that there's a lot more that impacts, I think, immigrants, just a lot more that impacts immigrants than just their culture, but also feeling that their culture and I'll be very specific to the Coptic community, is often under attack, is often, and in implicit and explicit ways. So like for the Coptic community, explicitly, January 7th is not a recognized religious holiday here, even though thousands of students don't go to school on January 7th because it is Coptic Christmas, and MNPS refuses to recognize that. So even though it would be structurally better for them to just know, and I know a bunch of MNPS teachers who already know this and mentally have blocked it off, but explicitly they don't want to recognize that holiday, and they don't want to recognize how important it is to thousands of their students and parents. And then there's a lot of implicit things. So, for instance, a lot of Coptic people where right now in Lent are fasting. And I remember a lot of times even having, like, and I grew up in Williamson County, too. So this is a predominantly white suburb compared to Nashville. But I hear the same thing about Nashville, because I don't want anyone to say that Nashville is better than, like, Rutherford County or Williamson County. I don't think so. A lot of teachers who don't know what that is, who don't know what like fasting is, don't know what the, you know, how I want to regulate myself during Lent, and how just, and the other issue too is like there's a sense of like it's appropriate to question people's choices and how they connect with community. So I had a bunch of teachers and students who would say fasting is not necessary, and because we're in the South. So I think that's a very important perspective. It's like a lot of Protestants here in the South, and they think it's appropriate to challenge people religiously. And so that's like an implicit racism, where there's a sense of my Christianity and the way I do Christianity is superior to how brown and black people relate to religion, specifically in Christianity. So this is to say, there are like so many systems that are set against immigrants. Some of them are shared. So some of them are like housing and schooling. And the housing displacement is something like all community members, or a good chunk of community members in Nashville, are going through. And then some of them may be a little more specific to the way Nashville is not set up to respect that there are people who have different cultures. And there are people, it's not appropriate to ask a child to explain a religious, what is Ramadan? And can you explain to me what they were doing in 1498 to bring about this fast or whatever? And I also, in that sense, I also think that a lot of our kids have to grow up very quickly, because they have to explain everything to every adult in the room. They're in the doctor's office, and the doctor is like, I don't understand where the pain is for your parent. And the kid then has to explain that. So when the tornado hit in December of 2023 in Madison, imagine if you speak Somali or you speak Arabic or Kurdish, what happens in a crisis? And the children who are bilingual, who have to grow up very quickly and have to be very familiar with, you know, the tax system and the government. And this is how you talk to a white person if you want something done. And this is how you talk to a white person if you know, there's a crisis, you know? And I think that that's really, really sad. And I think when you see children have to do that and what a strain it is, you can only imagine the adults that they become. And in Mahabba, we deal with a lot of kids. And it's always just really sad to me when I see children, you know, as young as 5 years old, who have just grown up and they already know this is a white person. I can't say no to what's happening to me. I just have to let it happen. I have to let the disrespect happen. So
that literally happened with my mom. There was a lot of cases with when my mom first moved here, she, in a lot of the workplace places that she was in, she was experiencing some like really intense racism where people would just be like, we don't want you here. Like, go back to your country. Like, stuff. Yeah. Just like really intense, hostile, degrading, demoralizing environments.
Yeah.
Without your choosing constantly, it makes you like the stress that comes from that causes a lot of actual health issues, like health problems.
Yeah.
But what about like the mental health aspect? Like, over time, we know that there's like depression, we know that there's anxiety, and of course like we have community and we like don't talk about depression and like anxiety and all that stuff, and in the Egyptian community specifically, like growing up, we never just openly talked about it because it just wasn't like a thing that, you know, it'd be like go to God or like pray to God and stuff like that. How can we do better to help each other with that mental health like aspect?
You know, mental health is a very interesting topic because it can be weaponized, which I feel there are people within our community who can weaponize the topics of mental health. So this is going to get in very niche Coptic territory, but I'm sure it's going to become relevant that the church here has a huge propaganda. There are high rates of domestic violence here in Nashville, sexual abuse, and a lot of material conditions that the church does not want to negotiate or fix or really engage because these are hard topics. So what they do is they find comfort in discussing it as a mental health issue. So the people who abuse these women are just mentally ill and you have to work with him. You know, if you say you're queer, it's a mental illness, right? And so I see that on our side of the community where there isn't a healthy discussion coming in about what mental health is and that it's just simply weaponized as something, you know, you need help. Instead of saying this is a reaction to their material condition and it needs to be treated because their material condition is created by their community. Now, whether, you know, there can be an argument that the church doesn't create that material condition of domestic violence or sexual abuse, and that's like white supremacy, that's fine. But like, we can't get there if we're not discussing what is the environment that is causing the harm. Because to me, mental illness is a reaction to what is going on. And so, or what has been happening. And I even know, you know, and sometimes we don't even diagnose it properly. So like for me, I was always told, as someone who's an eldest daughter in an immigrant household, I cannot stop working. And it's a really big problem that I've always had. There's a sense of like, I just can't stop. I can't stop. I can't stop. Because I always have to have something. I can't relax. I can't sit down. Even like if you remove me from Nashville and put me somewhere else, I'm going to keep answering DMs and calling people and checking in on people and making sure like all the work is finished and like I can start on this spreadsheet. And I had a French teacher once say to me in high school, she looked at me and she was like, "Too late. Oh, machine. You're a machine. Like, stop." And that's something within the capitalist system, you know, and I have a lot of people who come up to me who say, "Oh, you work so hard. You're a hard worker. You're so diligent. You're doing such great work." And I really want to tell them it's a mental illness. It's a mental illness. This is not healthy. Within capitalism, you like this because you like someone who's constantly producing and someone who's constantly grinding and making sure things are happening because that fits the agenda. That fits what you want the image of the United States to be.
Well, it hits but hard for immigrants, not... too. Like, for yeah. the, like if regular American people, you know, the American people, whatever, are doing this regularly, for immigrants, we're like up on a 5,000 level more because we're like, we got to be grinding like every single second.
I had someone tell me my dad is retired. Well, he's technically still working like 40, 60 hours, but he's like, he wants to do it for free now.
That's retirement hours. 40 to 60 hours.
And I was telling a community member, I was like, that's so unhealthy. Like he's now 65. I want him to relax. Yeah. And she was like, no, if Egyptian men stop working, they're going to die. Do you want your dad to die?
Yeah.
And I was like, what a twist.
That is literally what my dad said to me. He was like, if I stop working, I'm going to die.
Yeah. There's no sense of like, it's a numbness of like, I just don't want to feel anything. Because if I felt what I'm feeling, what's happening to my family, what's happening to my community, I'm going to feel really angry. And I'm going to do things that society is going to say is irrational.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. When it is a completely rational reaction to what we are all going through.
Yeah.
You are not crazy for reacting the way you're reacting.
What is
to what's
it that
going on?
James Baldwin said to be black and relatively conscious is to be in
a rage. Constantly in a state of rage. Yes.
And it's like that.
And the mental health industry is going to tell you, no, regulate self-care. And yeah. that is not the response. That is
Let me tell you. So with Be Well, I have, so I've been doing this for 2 years now, and we have, now we have a lot of yoga classes, meditation classes, sound baths. There's just a lot of that just, you know, to soothe and regulate the nervous system type classes.
Yeah.
But I'm like thoroughly convinced that there, those types of things do not soothe the microaggressions that come out of prejudice from racism specifically, at least for, it's not just me, it's other, I'm seeing it with other people too. No matter how, bro, it doesn't matter how many yoga classes you go to and how much it's, sound bath you you sit in.
The trauma is there.
If people are treating you like every day, subconsciously, and you cannot like pinpoint it, and you have to keep your guard up in a state of like fight or flight all day, you're going to be mad. Like, you're going to be sad, mad, frustrated, which is eventually going to turn into rage. And how do you deal with that? You either like find hobbies. Like, I have like, I'm like, I go home and I'm like sanding wood and working on my car and like cook. And I'm doing all of these things to just like soothe, to get my mind and like soothe my mind. Cause if I just like sit there, I'll be like, oh man, that things interaction at work, like, or like, or that person that I talked to, like, or that email that I got that was like just so blatantly racist, and this person just is not realizing this. And I don't want to like feel that. I don't want the anger to turn into rage, is what I'm trying to say. Because when when it gets into like...
But I'm sad you have to regulate yourself that much.
Well, that's just the thing that we have to like deal with. And so that's why I have like a lot of respect for like... I don't want to say like men or women kind of thing, but like my mom can deal with that in a healthy way, it seems like.
You know, and I also think because women have outlets. Yeah, and I feel like men... Men have not developed those really well-running, not well-running, but like those connections.
Well, the crutch was drugs. Yeah. So it's like
the crutch was drugs.
I feel like men developed that connection with drugs.
Oh, the connection.
You know what
with
I mean?
Drugs.
Or something. But I don't want to say that. But I think statistically, I mean, I know in the Coptic community, there's a lot of numbing with drug usage, and it's not for recreation. Like a lot of the people that I know that have like intense addictions or have like struggled with addictions are not like they're not like recreationally doing bars and like drinking themselves to like blacking out like for fun, you know what I mean? Like, they're not like I'm gonna do this, like I'm gonna wake up and do, like they're doing it because there's so much pain that they just don't have, they don't have the way to deal with it, like they don't have a way to deal with it, so you just gotta numb it. But Yeah, and now the Department of Health actually is like targeted the Egyptian Coptic community with the overdoses. So now they're like, you know, I don't want to get too much into that, but now they're like,
that's a whole other thing. Yeah,
they're like, hey, where are the hotspots? Hey guys, we are here to help. Like, and it's like kind of weird.
And that's another way of using health to not talk about the material conditions. They just do not want to talk about what is happening. I had a very good conversation with my brother about this because he's like, there's an opioid crisis. it's a social problem.
Yeah.
And it's because we have not been connected as a community, because our second gen in particular feel like they're being torn between multiple cultures, multiple systems of oppression. And they're losing memory of who they are, of who their family is. And on top of that, they're in a segregated South Nashville. So, I mean, it even is like ridiculous to ask somebody, you know, who went to a segregated school, who's now working, you know, whatever odd job that they can get. And they don't have many friends because they don't go to church. And that's the only social network that we have in our community. And then be like, why are you...
Yeah,
why are you taking drugs? It's like, it's kind of obvious. You don't need a survey.
Yeah. But that's what they like to do. They like to sophisticate the racism now these days. So instead of like having like signs like outside of the place or whatever, or like, you know, blatantly creating laws or whatever. So now it's this sophisticated kind of like, well, let's study this zip code and see what's going on here.
Let's put a grant behind.
Yeah, and so we can get a grant so that we can help them, like, you know, get up here where the healthy people are. Like, you know what I mean?
So it's then the healthy people are like neurologically mentally ill. Like neurologically mentally ill.
Another way of othering too. It's another way of taking a community that is already marginalized, that is already separate and ignored, and making them, and here's another label for you to further be differed from me.
Yeah. And they're not giving us, or they're not giving the community, like, the ability to regulate itself. They're like, you have to be dependent on us and our money for us to
solve.
And
we can do this.
Like, I just want to go back to the idea of like biculturalism. I feel like code switching, like all of these words and phrases and stuff that we have for like that type of thing that makes you feel inauthentic in a way where you, you're kind of like, I am like this. So like I'm Egyptian and also I have an American side, and like my, how do I like balance my Americanness with my Egyptianness? Yeah. And like, as I get older, like, what is more important to me, and like, who am I? And it is this whole identity crisis thing in the Egyptian community since ancient times. Like, the priests were the people to go to, like, since Imhotep, you know what I mean? Like, since ancient times, like, it was the priests, like, that ran the whatever. You go to them. So that trickled down to, like, now, like, our community center, like, the basketball court, like, everything is in this, like, church or mosque or wherever you go for spiritual, religious, aspects. And a huge struggle for me has been, like, I don't want to go to, like, a religious cleric for, like, mental health advice. Yeah. Like, I want to go to, like, a priest to talk about my depression, or, like, I want to go to, like, an imam to talk about my, like, anxiety. Mm-hmm. They're just not, like, they're not going to help me in the way that I need. Mm. Like, so what do you think, like, El Mahabba or like, what can we do to, like, tackle that? Because a lot of us, like, feel that inauthenticity, or, like, what do you think?
I think it's very important to have third spaces, and I'm hoping that's what El Mahabba can be. I already see, like, a lot of restorative things happen when you just let people come together. And we just can't do that in Nashville because of segregation, white supremacy. And then you have the patriarchy within our own cultures coming in and kind of centering their own power. And I think that's also the difficulty in speaking with a lot of white people about this topic, because they often are just like, oh, well, let's do something within your culture. What do you do in your culture? And it really ignores that there's always a dominating culture and there's always a subculture. So in Nashville, your dominating culture is like the religious culture, unfortunately. And then your subcultures are things like in Mahabba Center coming in. So anyways, and it's just very annoying because I get that it's a form of racism where white people think they're being like, I'm caring about you because I care about your culture. And it's not
caring. Your white girl accent is so on point.
I love it. Yeah. It's one of the best things. My accents are so good, actually. If I could do a multitude of characters.
That should have been our icebreaker. Sidebar. My dad had, he told me when they were, like, growing up in Nashville, like, him and his friends would do, like, black people have, like, colloquialism. Yeah. We'll be like, right on, man. Like, they would do, like, right on to each other. Uh-huh. And he said the white people in his area thought they were saying right arm because they were raising their arm.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Like, black power. But he said they would see white people and they'd be like, right arm. And it's the funniest thing I've ever heard. Dang. So sometimes
if
we walk around the house.
It's not an allegory for appropriation. Like, literally, they think they're like doing it and it's like, on. You don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, so speaking of white people, though, can we break down, because what you were like kind of hinting at it and referencing it earlier with the different types of racism now that we experience in a predominantly white culture, in our workplaces, and just in our social lives in general. So you have different types of racism now that's like, now it's become like You have interpersonal racism, structural racism, institutionalized racism. So break down the different kinds of racism that are existing.
Oh, my God. You know, and it all stems. Yeah. Okay. There's a lot I can speak to. And I think we're always very used to, oh, he said the N-word. That is racism. Or they called you a terrorist. That is racism. And that's not even, you know, I think what the majority of us face. I feel like that's not what we're facing, especially in a city like Nashville, where you have a lot more white liberals. A lot of it comes from parentalism or like just patronizing attitudes towards people of color all the time. So a lot of times white people assume that they can be the savior in a problem, and they only see themselves as the saviors in the situation. So they may enter something where they have caused harm and then flip it to be like, well, I'm going to be the one and not apologize, but be like, well, you messed up on this procedure here and here and here, but don't worry, we're going to work with you.
It's so, like the ultimate psychological manipulation.
Yeah, where it's like, just say you did something wrong. It's okay. Like, please recognize that I'm a human being. You're a human being. And you don't need to be like, according to the bylaws of Section 37.8, we are human beings. We do not need to go through the full Constitution. You know what you did.
Yeah.
I know what happened.
Yeah,
you
I
don't
just
need
say,
to gaslight.
I just want to say, as a side note to that, too, Arab men, like, are so, is so fast to cancel them. Like, if they do any little thing, it's like somebody's waiting for them to, like, mess up. And then it's like, done. Like, don't call me no more. Don't text me no more. Like, it's so fast.
Yeah.
It's, like, so quick.
Black and brown people, I feel like a lot of us are feel very disposable because we are treated as such. Like, our thoughts and our feelings do not often matter. Let's just be real. I mean, it's not even just about how we feel, right? Like, they don't matter.
Yeah.
And that is what's communicated in a lot in legislation. That's what's communicated in our workplaces, in creative spaces, your thoughts, your mind.
And you should be grateful that we're even listening or you're even in the room. You know how many people are not in the room? That is the whole situation with Metro Arts, actually, because it's a lot of the white people in control assume people of color should be grateful with the little money that they got. Like, historically, you guys have never gotten this amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
When, one, this is our tax dollars. So historically, you have robbed us of money. So that's what's happening here. And currently, we are asking for that money. We're asking for that money. Actually, we're not even asking for it. That money is ours. So even the way they set up the whole idea of, like, you should be grateful. We are working towards equity, and it doesn't happen quickly. You have to wait for procedures and time. But, yeah, all of that is extremely dehumanizing.
Yeah.
And all of that can be internalized by people of color. And it's just really sad, because also in this journey with dealing with what's happening at Metro Arts and the defunding of artists, is to hear artists say, like, I'm, like, too tired to face these white people. Like, I'm really, like, they got the time and the money to come up with any argument, any distraction, any, like, go research this and come up with a good answer. And they can lie on the stand. They can lie on the stand and keep their positions on the record and be and start crying, too. So they can be like, I'm sorry, I didn't even know. And like, and we have to deal with that.
One white woman's tear.
Oh, don't even get me started on the weaponization.
50,000 dead Palestinian babies.
Yeah.
For every tear she cries.
Yeah, and that's also dehumanizing.
Yeah.
To sit there and be in pain and not be funded and have your art projects halted. And then to hear white commissioners be like, well, I mean, this whole situation is so heavy. Heavy for who?
Yeah.
So it's even the lack of positionality to just continually want to be the better person. And I really try to tell white people, anti-racism is not about being a good person. Treating people of color like human beings is baseline.
Yes.
We're not talking about, wow, you are such a nice person because you're so nice to black people. Or, oh my God, the Arabs, you know, they deserve your great comfort and wise words. That's not what it is. You're not an empathetic person. You're not kind. You're not respectful. You are just seeing the other person in front of you like a human being. We have not even begun to develop empathy.
Yeah.
And sorry, I'm going to just say one more thing, that a lot of anti-racism work, I don't want kind words. I don't want an apology as much. Like, the apology is for you to recognize what you did as wrong for your mental health to get the story right. But it's about the redistribution. And a lot of times when we talk about the redistribution part, like, you stole something from me, that's when all the tears come out. That's when all the, like, but I'm a nice person comes out. Like, I promise I donated, blah, blah, blah. And, like, the whole waterworks. And then they reframe the conversation into, you know, anti-racism is about being nice, when that's not what we're talking about. I will also say that a lot of institutions use DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives. I was just talking to, actually, my sister this morning about this, as insurance policies, you know, to be like, oh, well, it's not racism because we had a racism seminar.
Yeah.
So again, a lot of these practices of, like, the nice white person can actually be extremely harmful to people of color.
I think it's more harmful, actually.
Like,
I think
easily manipulated.
It's like, I would rather you physically hurt me than this, like, mental, like, psychological warfare.
At least I can understand physical pain.
Yeah, physical pain I can handle.
To some extent.
But, like, mental gymnastics that I have to, like,
that is exhausting.
That I have to see happening in front of my face, and then gaslighting.
And how much labor. Like, I am, it is so sad to see people of color do so much to be like, oh, wait, I was right. This is what happened.
Yeah.
Hold up.
I'm not crazy. I'm not being overdramatic.
It's tragic. And that all, you know, I always think about, like, how much that carries in DNA, too. And in passing that on to next generations, not just, like, in our interactions with people now, but, like, people who have children, and how that impact. Like, I'm always talking about memory, too. So this is, like, a very big thing for me. But how our body keeps, I don't want to say keeps the score, because that book was stolen labor from people of color. Oh. So don't read that book. Dang, that is it. One book we should not be reading. But that the genetic makeup and our bodies, like, remember, and we'll pass that on to the next generation.
Undrowned is a better version of that.
Undrowned.
Yeah. Alexis Pauline Gums, Undrowned.
Thank you for
beautiful. Thank
the
you.
Book, the book insert. Yes. We work in a library.
Yeah.
She talks about how marine mammals, she breaks down how marine mammals' bodies keep the score, basically. Yeah.
And you know, I 100% believe in that, because it's the weirdest thing as a diaspora baby when you go back and you feel like you know things. Like, I had never been to Egypt until I was like 12.
Man.
And when I went, I was like, I know this. I don't know. I've never been here. And I was expecting it to be a foreign country, because I was like very like red, white, and blue.
Fruits.
And then I got there. Yeah. mental illness. and I got there and I was like, oh my God, I know these streets. I know these people. Yeah. I know what's happening around me.
When I was there, I was just recently there. And when I was there, I felt like I was so normal. Like, normalized.
Yeah.
Like, or whatever. I finally understood what it means for your immune system to be regulated nervous system.
Yeah.
And you're just, like, chilling among people. Nobody's worried about your name. Nobody's worried about your, like, what you look like. Nobody's worried about
Can we call you Sam?
Yeah, like, what you do, who you are. You're just, like, a person. You walk into a store, like, people are, like, looking. Like, it's chill. It's chill.
Yeah.
And I strive so hard for that here in Nashville, to just be normal. I just want to be normal.
Yeah.
I just wish my name was, like, Dylan Smith or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't wish that, but, like, somebody. I just want to be, like, just this white dude who just shows up to collect.
And I can be mediocre.
Yeah, and just be mediocre. Nothing is expected of me.
And nobody expects anything.
Everybody thinks your jokes are funny. You have no political analysis. You can say the dumbest things for, like, 5 minutes and everyone's like, wow.
How can we go forward and better see immigrant communities, better see immigrant people as human beings, so that we can all contribute. Like you were saying earlier, like what you do at El Mahaba. I don't want to mess this up, but El Mahaba.
Yes.
How do you see outsiders become a part of this community?
Fight against segregation is a big one, right? If we can live in communities together, eat together, that's the material condition is going to shape whatever is going on internally with us and how we see each other and, right, who is superior, who's not. So I think first and foremost, plug into a movement that's working against racism and very explicitly. So do not trust DEI initiative orgs or like organizations that are willing to just comfort politicians. Be very intentional with the organizations you reach out to and be on the ground. Segregation is not going to be fixed within the next year, but you can definitely within this year plug into a movement and a space that works on the ground with community members and then stay in those systems. I think one of the problems within Nashville is we automatically meet conflict and then things break apart very quickly. So I urge people to embrace conflict because conflict is a part of intimacy and is a part of relationship building and then greater community building. So to stay in those spaces, those movement spaces, if you're not a movement person, find mentors within the community. It's really important to, because I'm not advocating for people to just go volunteer. I'm not one of those people. To be intentional with where you go and how you're helping and how you're supporting community and make community. Yeah, so I'm not asking you to go to an organization and be like friends with a refugee family or like pass out at a food bank to some immigrants. I mean, like very intentional connection to community members. We have like tutors in our program who have known kids for years and have brought up that kid for years in our tutoring program and know like so much about them. And even though it may seem something small to tutor one child for like 4 years and move them, you know, from middle to high school into college, it is life changing for that kid to feel like there's another adult who sees me, who values me and who believes in me and is going to be at my graduation and is going to help get me through this. It's just a very important role for children. So I would just like to say there's no role that's too small as long as you are intentional and really basing everything off relationship. How can I really be in relationship with community members and understand and feel what's going on around me and not be numb?
Yeah. Amazing.
We can't be in despair. We have to hope and we have to put in that energy. We have to, hope is a discipline.
We have to
be disciplined in hoping.
That's a bar.
So I do have hope because we've all seen systems crumble and we've all seen, you know, good things come out of the ashes. So when we thought like it was over, the fire had destroyed everything. So I choose to hope and I believe in a lot of the community members involved within Mahaba Center were very multiracial. And so I see it happening in Nashville. I see the little sparks. So, you know, I pray every day that I get to see it within my lifetime, that I get a few years on Earth where I get to see a Nashville reborn and people who are not striving for the bare minimum, but really we want to take care of each other. And I feel like to make that change, people have to love each other and people have to fight for something that's not just themselves, you know?
Absolutely. Well, we're going to wrap it up. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you again to Lydia for coming out and speaking truth to power. Thank you for listening. And remember, your mind matters.